This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Good evening, everyone. I'm going to get us started. Welcome back to the third installment of Mini Med School in Pediatrics. We're so glad you're here. I'm Glenn Rosenbluth. I'm one of the co-chairs of the course. And this evening, it's my great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dr. Lee Atkinson McAvoy. Dr. Atkinson McAvoy is an associate professor in the Department of Pediatrics in the Division of General Pediatrics. And she's also the associate director of the Pediatric Residency Program, as well as carrying many other leadership roles throughout the UCSF Medical Center and the Benioff Children's Hospital. She is a former resident in our program, chief resident in our program, and then afterwards did a fellowship in academic general pediatrics, and then left for a while to Chicago, and then we were fortunate to recruit her back to UCSF several years ago. Tonight, following in our theme of relearning what we know about children and children's illnesses, Dr. Atkinson McAvoy is going to talk to us about the science behind old wives' tales, fact versus fiction.
Thank you. Before I start, I'll tell you why this topic actually interested me. So I see a lot of patients, a lot of children, parents come in with illnesses, and most of their illnesses are colds, viral infections, routine illnesses. And as we have progressed in medicine, I found that some of the things that I remember being done for me when I was a child, and that many of my patients' parents say, that's what my grandmother told me, that's what I was told to do, is what I'm now recommending. And so some of what I recommend and how it's changed is that there have been actually studies looking at some of the kind of old-fashioned cures that were used. So I'm going to go over some of the common things that you might resonate with you. I have a question-answer period, and it's not that you have to raise your hands, but internally think to yourself, do I actually think this old wives' tale might be true or not? And then I'll try to go over some of the evidence that might or might not help you decide for yourselves. I have no conflicts. I mentioned brand names in here, but I have no associations with any of those companies. And so our objective this evening is that we're going to review some of the commonly held beliefs about health and sickness with regards to children, and then explore some of the evidence around it. So really, we're talking about it. Is it these old wives? The idea that from certainly ancient times, what witches told, or women who sat around and gossiped, or the overbearing grandmother telling a new mother what to do, versus these old wives. And to let you know who they are, Rebecca Lee Crumpler, who's the wife of Arthur Crumpler, was the first African-American female physician. We all know Marie Curie. Her husband is Pierre Curie. She's Nobel laureate in physics and chemistry. And then Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, wife of James Anderson, who's the first female physician in England. So I thought we would go through these as chapters in a book. So the first old wives' tales we'll look at are things that might make you sick. So we all know this one. You have wet hair, or you go out in the cold, that's going to make you sick. So take a moment, think to yourself whether you think that's true or not, and then we'll go over some of the evidence. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about colds and where the term having a cold came into being. So it's recognized as early as 1550 BC, and it's in the ancient Egyptian Ebers Papyrus papers, which is considered the first medical text that ever existed. But the name the common cold became used more in the 16th century, where there was this recognition that when you had a cold, some of your symptoms were very similar to when the symptoms that you got when you're exposed to cold air. So if you go out into very cold air, you might get a runny nose, when you have a cold, you have a runny nose. You might have shivers from a fever with a cold, but you also have shivers from being exposed to the cold. Benjamin Franklin is one of the first people credited with really hypothesizing that really when you get the common cold, it's actually something that goes from person to person, not really due to cold air. And the idea that we should really study why people get colds was really kind of formalized in 1946, where in the UK they formed an institute which they call the Common Cold Unit, which still exists today, where a lot of what their work is devoted to studying the science behind colds and upper respiratory tract infections. And then actually it was at the Common Cold Unit that they discovered the first virus linked with the cold, which is rhinovirus in 1956. So here's what science and scientists believe that they know about the cold. That really viruses are the most common cause of colds, or the other term that we like to use is upper respiratory tract infections. And that common colds are caused by one of more than 100 different types of rhinoviruses. But there are many other viruses that can also cause the common cold. And that viruses come from a direct exposure. So you're exposed to somebody who has it and you get the symptoms. And so a mechanism that we think of for getting a cold is this is a sample virus, and the name rhinovirus came from it because the rhinovirus actually has this kind of shape with these pointy edges to it, almost like a rhinoceros. And it attaches to the outside of a cell, it gets internalized, replicates, and you then go on to have your infection. And the symptoms that we all know of, a common cold, runny nose, blocked nose, sneezing, sore throat, cough. And then sometimes people have more generalized symptoms such as headache, fever, anorexia, tiredness, or muscle aches. And these are some of the common accepted modes of how we transmit colds. You sneeze on your hand and you touch another surface and someone touches after you. You sneeze and you don't cover the sneeze and you're just aerosolizing a whole bunch of cold virus particles. And so that's mostly what people think causes a cold. But would cold air have anything to do with the cold virus? And so a lot of people have been interested in this. And as early as 1919, Mudd and Grant, two researchers in the UK, showed that when you're exposed to cold air, your blood vessels in your nose actually constrict. And they thought, your blood does something with protecting you. Maybe this makes you more susceptible or not as resistant to getting an infection. And then in 1965, Sir Andrews suggested that exposure to cold air actually activated a cold virus that was actually hanging out in your upper airway but wasn't quite active enough to replicate and made it somehow become active. And then in 2002, Dr. Eklis, and he is part of a group that actually works at the Common Cold Institute in the UK, looked at this old evidence and really suggested that he believed that this blood vessel constriction and what we know about how our immune system works in blood vessels and exposure to cold air making it constrict is inhibiting the normal defense mechanisms, converting an asymptomatic viral infection, meaning you have the virus living in your respiratory tract, into a symptomatic one that now it's replicating and causing symptoms. He went on to actually try to study this. And so in 2005, he got 180 healthy subjects, and he took them, they came to the Cold Institute, and half of them were randomized to have their feet put in a bucket of ice water. And the reason they did that, they didn't want the cold air near their face, and I've already discussed how the fact that exposure to cold makes you have a runny nose. And then he just took the other group and he put them in a room and they did some activities, but they were not exposed to any cold. And then what he did was contacted them for 4 to 5 days afterwards and tracked what symptoms and if they had any cold symptoms. So he knew coming in whether they were complaining of cold symptoms, and then he followed them. And 13 of the 90 who had their feet chilled reported that they were suffering from cold symptoms. And 5 of the 90 said they were reporting by day 5 having cold symptoms. And those who reported cold symptoms, interestingly enough, in both the study and the control group, also reported that in general they thought they had colds more often. So the conclusion of his paper was that acute chilling of the feet causes the onset of cold symptoms in around 10% of subjects who were chilled. Further studies are needed to determine the relationship of symptom generation to any respiratory infection. That sounds kind of reasonable, but the one thing to think about is those people who had their feet put in the cold water knew they had their feet put in the cold water, and it's a commonly held belief that exposure to cold makes you sick. And also the fact that the people who reported cold symptoms already feel that they themselves are more susceptible makes it hard to interpret this. But it does sound like they might be on to something. So, does being cold or going outside with wet hair make you sick? And the way wet hair works, which I don't know if I made very clear, is that your hair is wet. Your head is a vital place where you can actually lose heat from your body. So you have wet hair, you decrease the surface tension, the surface temperature of your head, and you allowed more heat from your body to evaporate to warm your skin. So I don't know that I would say this evidence definitely makes you sick from being out in the cold, but it might be one of the triggers that makes us sick if you're already carrying a virus. So really, I think to prevent yourself from getting sick, it's still the hand washing and the hand hygiene that we're taught. But that might play a role, particularly in those people who are susceptible. Okay, so the next question. Well, maybe cold makes you sick, maybe not. But stress definitely makes you sick. And I can tell you, I'm somebody who feels that way. I'm fighting off a cold of my own right now. And it's been a busy week for me, long days working hard. And I know every time I'm stressed out and I work really hard, I'm going to get sick. So you guys think for yourselves whether you agree. So here's some evidence looking at this question. So in 1991, some researchers were thinking this was likely, and they took 394 healthy subjects. And all of those subjects were either going to get drops in their nose, they were either going to get one of five different types of respiratory viruses, and they had a control group, 26 people, who just got plain saline in their nose. And of course, none of them knew what they were getting. And they had many, many assessments of stress. They knew a lot about the subjects, their overall health, their age, their gender, whether they smoked, drank alcohol, and they assessed all of these things about them, and they followed them for a week afterwards. And all the subjects were quarantined, and they were quarantined in separate living quarters. They were required to stay there for the 7 days of the study, and they actually even monitored for the people who might have developed symptoms, who else was living with them. And they also cultured them to see, well, if you did have symptoms, were you able to get a virus? And the rates of respiratory infection and clinical colds seem to increase in a dose-dependent manner with increases in psychological stress. So, for example, if somebody said they had recently suffered a majorly traumatic event, death of a loved one recently, a divorce or a stressful event, they were much more likely to have developed cold symptoms and show actual signs of having an upper respiratory tract infection. The one criticism about this study is the white counts stayed the same, and a lot of times we oftentimes think, okay, well, the reason we get colds when we're sick is that our immune system is waning, and they weren't able to demonstrate that. But they only looked at amounts, and we know amount isn't the only thing that counts. It could be how they're working. And actually, a study that was published earlier this year, so in March of 2012, they weren't looking at this question specifically, but they were looking to see how having negative social stressors in your life might actually just affect your immune markers and your inflammation. And one of the things that your white blood cells do when they are activated is they release certain chemicals into your body. And so they looked at individuals, and they did, again, a battery of surveys for self-identification of stress, and they did blood tests. They followed them for a while, and when at moments where they said that they felt most stressed, they actually did blood levels. And they actually saw that the more negative social interactions and negative stressors that individuals had, the higher these inflammatory markers, or that their white blood cells were releasing things, were circulating. And what they went on to postulate is that over time, people who suffer from more stress, those levels are so high all of the time that your body stops responding to them appropriately, which means that you then become susceptible to infection. So thinking about this, does stress get you sick? There's definitely mounting evidence, and stress can definitely lead to health concerns. We know it can lead to elevated blood pressure over time. We know it can increase your risk of cardiac disease. And it may very well, if you have chronic stress, make you more susceptible, certainly to infections like upper respiratory tract infections. So then after that, looking at that study, I had to change my recommendations. Wash your hands more often and make sure you're taking care of yourself and making sure that there's not too much stress going on at home. We all remember these photos from the SARS outbreak, but certainly flying. you know, so I did a flight from New York to Los Angeles. I'm going to get sick. That's exactly why I got sick. Taking a moment to think about that. So the rationale behind this is that travel, especially on commercial airplanes, is really a high-risk environment, and it's because you're in a confined space. You certainly have a lot of people sitting very close to you. There's limited ventilation. You're there for a very long time. There's lots of delays between boarding the plane and taking off, and certainly if you're doing prolonged travel. And airlines went to using recirculated air because it ended up cost savings for them. And all of those things are demonstrated as risk factors for somebody to be able to pass an infection from one person to another person. So really, there's been a lot of debate as to whether air travel can cause that. And actually, 50% of airlines, and it might be more now, have a standard recirculated air. And just to kind of go over how the recirculation works, so we can maybe think carefully about airfare. So this is a diagram of where the vents are. And the air enters the cabin from the above, and the vents are pointed in directions so they have this flow, and then air exits from below. And when it exits, it's actually taking some air from outside and some recirculated air. And so the thing to know is that when you're at 30 to 40,000 feet, which is a typical kind of cruising altitude, not a lot of microbes can survive at that level, so with the air coming from outside. And then they pressurize the cabin to about the equivalent of 3,000 to 4,000 feet. But when they pressurize the air, that puts a lot of pressure on the walls of the cells of those organisms that they're typically not used to. So that can also cause some destruction. They heat the air to 800 degrees centigrade. And then it passes through this series of the air is heated and then refrigerated and heated again. And then it eventually is refrigerated to an appropriate ambient temperature, and then it is sent out into the air cabin. And 50% of the air is recirculated, and that's a cost savings for the airlines. And they use HEPA filters for those recirculated air that eliminates 99.9% of bacteria and viruses. And the other thing to know is the humidity is quite low, 10 to 20%. And organisms like moisture are something to stick to, including moisture in the air. And the rate of air exchange in an airplane is 20 times per hour. If you think of our typical office building, I don't get to say, oh, the reason I'm sick today is because I went into the office. It's only 12 times per hour, so much less often, and they do use recirculated air in office buildings. And in your typical home, when you open your window, open the doors, the rate of air kind of being refreshed is about 5 times per hour. But we can't neglect the evidence and certainly news reports of infections acquired on airplanes. So air crew have a really high rate of influenza-like illness, particularly in the winter, up to as high as 33%, whereas in the general population, it's somewhere around 10 to 15% at any one time might complain of flu-like symptoms in a non-epidemic year. And in 1979, there was an Alaskan Airlines jet that had a three-hour ground delay. And the reason that made news is because they had some engine problems. They couldn't return to the gate, and they had to shut down the ventilation system. And within 72 hours, 72% of the passengers and 40% of the crew had actually gotten influenza. So it was considered this mini-influenza epidemic. And also, in 1993 to 1995... the CDC had to conduct investigations 6 times on people who were aboard planes for a prolonged period of times who were found to have active TB. And part of their process, if someone has active TB, they have to track down everybody who was exposed to that patient. And they have found mixed results. They found some of those investigations, there were more people converting their TB test to positive without any other known exposure. And there were some where they didn't find anybody else on the flight, but it's hard when it's one individual. And so the general conclusion is that overall transmission is low on a regular flight, but certainly if you're on a plane where they have to turn off the ventilation system, so those moments when you're sitting on there and it gets stifling hot, remember they are not recirculating the air and treating the air, so that might be important. But really, it increases with the proximity and duration to the source patient. So when they looked at those flights, the lucky 28% of those passengers who didn't get sick were sitting very far away from the person who was ill. And the reason why only 40% of the crew had gotten it is most of the crew weren't by that particular person who was sick. They were at the front of the plane or communicating with the ground crew. So air travel making you sick, possibly, it's definitely true. But more importantly, think of all the surfaces that you touch when you're on the plane. Has it been cleaned before? Did the person who was sitting on that flight right before you have an infection and they touched the rails, they pulled down the seat back in front of them, you go to the bathroom, you touch the handles, and then you touch your face? That's most likely to be the case. Certainly, if you happen to be that poor, unfortunate person sitting next to somebody who's coughing, the chances of you getting that illness are pretty high because the air is not being recirculated before it gets to you. So chapter 2 in our old wives' tales. So now we have an understanding of things that might get us sick, but really what we want to do is when we're sick, how can we get better and how can we get better as soon as possible? So this is definitely an old adage. It's you feed a cold, starve a fever. So this actually was a study. I like this study because my take on it in the backstory is that they only studied 6 healthy, non-smoking males. And so I feel it was like everybody who worked in that lab, somebody had been sick or somebody's family member has been sick and they came up and it's like, is it feed a cold or is it feed a fever, starve a cold? I don't know. And they probably decided, why don't we study it? So it was a Dutch group that studied it in 2002. And what they noticed, their results and conclusion, is that how much food you take in, so whether you're in a starvation state or whether you're in a relatively full state, actually changes the ratio of 2 important cell types in your immune system. One cell type is called Th1, and one cell type is called Th2. And so when you eat more food, you have higher levels of gamma interferon in your blood. And the production is made by your Th1 cells, and of note, Th1 cells help you fight viruses. When you're food deprived, so you're in starvation, your body makes interleukin-4, IL-4. It's another type of immune chemical that's released, and it's made by your Th2 cells, and your Th2 cells are really important for killing bacteria. And the other thing to note is that oftentimes, and you know this when you go to the doctor, when you say you've been sick, we always want to know, have you had fever? And there's this feeling that if you say no, they're going to say, oh, you're totally fine. But if you say yes, then something's really wrong and we need to think about it. Fever oftentimes occurs with bacterial infection or more significant infections, particularly in adults. Unfortunately for me in pediatrics, that's not always so helpful because the first time you get an infection, you oftentimes have a fever, whether it's a common cold or more serious infection. So that's the best set of studies I could find on this. The problem is only 6 males. They're assuming just because they ate a lot or were in starvation, they were the only things that actually changed their immune cell numbers. And they didn't actually look at whether they were developing symptoms of an illness. They didn't comment in the paper that we were quarantined from those around us. So it's hard to say, but it does seem to kind of support the adage you should feed a cold and potentially starve a fever. So one of the things to know is that viruses can cause fever just as well as bacteria. And viruses, most viruses are benign, but there are some serious viruses out there. So whether you have a fever or not doesn't necessarily distinguish with whether you're very ill or not. And also, if you think about it, in order for your body to fight an infection, it needs nutrition. Nutrition is what your cells use to make energy and to do the various things that they have to do, including your immune cells. So you should probably not starve yourself to try and get yourself over an infection. So the way I took this one is I more said, you're going to do hand washing, you're going to take care of yourself for stress, and then healthy eating and drink fluids are pretty much the reasonable things to do when you're sick. So this is my favorite one. This is my favorite question and favorite answer. Chicken soup cures a cold, or when you're sick, drink some chicken soup. And we've all had that experience of someone telling us that, and we've all had that experience of probably drinking some chicken soup. So this is a long tradition, back to the 12th century, where chicken soup was identified as a cure for the respiratory tract infections. And in order to kind of understand maybe how this might help with having a respiratory tract, we need to take a step back and think about when we get sick, why we have the symptoms that we have, or really how our body responds to a cold virus. So the one thing to understand is most of the symptoms that we find bothersome about an illness isn't the illness causing it. It is our immune system trying to create a hostile environment for that invading virus that causes the symptoms. So fever is actually generated from a point within our brains. And the reason we elevate our body temperature, we're trying to make it really uncomfortable for that virus or bacteria to replicate. We want to slow down their function. But we don't like having fever. The other thing that's most important about having a cold are all the secretions, whether they're in your nose or they're in your chest, we find them very bothersome. So how those secretions come is when you start getting sick, your blood vessels dilate. That's your body's trying to get all those immune cells go to the area where the virus is invading, and it's oftentimes in our airway. So you have more blood flow. The other thing is your blood vessels change and become leaky so that those inflammatory molecules and those white blood cells can cross out of the blood vessels into the tissue, which is where the virus is likely to be. And then our white blood cells come sticky so that when they get to the right location, they don't continue on in our circulating bloodstream and go someplace else. And one of the important white blood cells to respond quickly to infections is called a neutrophil. And it's one of our most important types of white blood cells. And they travel to the site of viruses and bacteria. So this sounds good. This is great that we're doing that. But neutrophils in particular produces a lot of chemicals that make us secrete fluid that would be inside our blood vessels to being outside of our blood vessels. And that explains why you feel dehydrated, right? And why people become dehydrated, because the fluid is coming from inside your blood vessels to now hanging out in your nasal tissue. So that's why you get runny nose, congestion, cough, and all that sputum production that we find so bothersome. And really, when we look for treatments, when we talk about curing our colds, we want those symptoms to go away. Whether the virus is still there or not oftentimes doesn't affect us. It's our immune response system that we don't like. And so chicken soup in particular was proposed to kind of help with those symptoms. So in 2000, and the publication CHEST is a very prestigious pulmonary and cardiovascular publication, they published this article, Chicken Soup Inhibits Neutrophil Chemotaxis, and chemotaxis is the fancy name to describe the fact that the neutrophils move to the site of the infection, but it was an in vitro study, so they didn't use live people. So they had a study where they made chicken soup according to a recipe, and I'll show you the recipe in a minute. And they took the soup, and they looked at the broth, and they looked at they pureed all those vegetables that were in it, and they looked at the chicken, and they put it in a little petri dish, and they put some neutrophils, and they looked to see what the neutrophils did. They put something that the neutrophil liked to go to on the other side of the petri dish, and then would put the various parts of the soup in the middle to see how it affected how the neutrophils would migrate. And what they found was there was something in the chicken soup that prevented the neutrophils from moving. And the reason that is attractive, because if the neutrophils don't all come to your nose and give you all that congestion and runny nose, we actually don't mind so much the fact that there is a cold virus living in our body. And so they found that the activity was present in the broth, so you filtered out all the veggies and the chicken, and it was also, they describe it as the particulate matter, but it's like they pureed all the vegetables because that was the only way they could actually fit it all on the petri dish. So it was in all that goodness in the soup, and it was also in the chicken. They also looked at some commercial soups, and I'll show you their results on that. And so their study, their conclusion, they said, the present study suggests that chicken soup may contain a number of substances with beneficial medicinal activity by serving as a mild anti-inflammatory. So here's the recipe. The thing of note that I found really interesting is, you know, I don't know how any of you make your chicken soup, but I've never done sweet potatoes or parsnips or turnips. So those, it was really kind of, it sounds like a healthy soup. And at the bottom, they actually talked about that really to make the soup better, they actually made matzo balls and put it in there. And they talked about the brand that they used to make it. They didn't make those from scratch. And they also talked about that if the chicken, they didn't use it further in the soup really, so the carcass of the chicken that was left, they said the meat makes an excellent chicken parm. So you have lots of options with that recipe of what you can do with it. But if you're like me, a busy person, making a pot of homemade soup from scratch doesn't really help you. And so the thing to think about it is, this is showing how much the neutrophils move. And what you want is down here where they don't move very well. The top two is some kind of positive control. So that was what the normal things that make neutrophils move. They use tap water because maybe it's just something being in the petri dish was going to interrupt things. And then they diluted all the soups to a concentration of 1 in 40. And Campbell's ramen noodles, not surprising, not particularly active in decreasing symptoms. And the best performer was Knorr's chicken flavor chicken noodle. Campbell's Healthy Requests and Campbell's Home Cooking also performed pretty well. But you can see there's a number of over-the-counter brands that you can use if you're too sick to make your own soup from scratch. And they all seem to kind of prevent those neutrophils from moving. So the only downside of this study, it was in a petri dish. Like, really, how is the chicken? We're not putting chicken soup in our nose, right? We're drinking it. So how exactly is that going to work? And most of the symptoms we don't like are in our nose, not particularly in our mouth. So there were a couple other studies I found looking at this, and they used humans to study, so 15 healthy studies, and they were looking at kind of the warm vapors from the soup, which a lot of people will talk about the warmth and the steam helping. I remember growing up that when I was sick, my mom would boil hot water, and there'd be a pot, and I'd have a towel over my head and my head over that steam as it was coming up. So looking at really, was it the warmth or something else that made a difference? And so what they did in these healthy subjects is they did a special technique to measure airway resistance. So how quickly air could move from the front of the nose to the back of their nose, postulating that if you had more mucus, it moves more slowly. If your nose is clear, it moves faster. And so they measured people at baseline, how long it just takes you in general to move air through your nose. None of these people were sick, but they gave them hot water, chicken soup, cold water, and then measured their airway flow in 5 to 30 minute intervals. And what they saw is that hot fluids thin the mucosa so more air can pass quickly. Hot water was better than cold water, but not as effective as hot chicken soup. So there's something in those vapors coming from the chicken soup that seemed to help. And they also looked at a study that said hot tea and chicken soup can help the function of your cilia. Cilia are like tiny hairs in your airway, and its job is to move mucus along. And so the heat from tea and chicken soup also help those things to function. So thinking about that one, while chicken soup doesn't cure your cold, because curing it would be that it eliminated the virus, it definitely can make you feel better and help with some of the symptoms. And even better, at least even better for me, there's lots of store brands that brands you can buy in the store that can help. And then hot tea also may help with your symptoms. So for a lot of my patients, if they're old enough where I don't have to worry about them burning themselves, I recommend to their parents when they come in and they can't breathe and they're miserable, hot tea, chicken soup, and they all say, "That's what my mom said." All right, and how many of you have heard this one? This is a new one, and maybe some of you have even been recommended this by your providers, but honey eliminates cough. And I remember chamomile tea with lemon and honey was the other beverage my mom gave me when I was young, when I was sick. So maybe Winnie the Pooh was on to something. You never saw him sick, did you? So this was a study actually done in children, and the reason the study was actually done was there was increasing evidence that over-the-counter cold medications actually cause significant side effects in children, so much so that now the labeling of cold medications is it's not indicated for children under the age of 6, and it was because there were so many kids showing up in the emergency room with significant side effects, cardiac arrhythmias, altered mental status, from having regular cold medications as their parents were valiantly trying to help them with their symptoms. So the idea to look at honey, which people had talked about for a long time as a potential solution, was attractive. So there was a study where they looked at 105 kids, 2 to 18 years of age. They had been sick for 7 days or less, and the key thing of their upper respiratory tract infection was that they had a nighttime cough. And we all know that nighttime cough just ruins sleep. And they were given a single dose of buckwheat honey. And I have to say, I find it interesting they picked buckwheat honey. Having known about this study, every store I go into, I look at the varieties of honey that they have, and I never find buckwheat honey. So I'm not quite sure where they found buckwheat honey or why they chose buckwheat honey. And the unique thing about buckwheat honey versus clover honey is that's the flower that the bee was feeding on when they made their honey. They tried honey-flavored dextromethorphan, and that's something that has been tried by various cough syrup companies, is to add honey flavoring into their cough syrup, or no treatment. It was given 30 minutes prior to bedtime. And they asked the parents to report what they thought their cold symptoms were. And so they did paired comparison of the children, and they found that honey was a lot better than getting nothing. And they couldn't say that honey was better than the honey-flavored dextromethorphan, but they definitely could say that honey-flavored dextromethorphan was not better than doing nothing at all. So honey seemed to come out as a really good treatment. And there was another study, a Cochrane review, and I don't know if you've heard other instructors talk about a Cochrane review. So the Cochrane database is a database where people try to get together a whole bunch of different studies, because everybody does their own little study, and get all the data together and try to compare it to give you a larger number of people to think about. So they reviewed 2 randomized controlled trials looking at honey versus diphenhydramine, which is sold under the brand name Benadryl. And they definitely saw that honey was better than doing nothing, and also better than diphenhydramine. But when they put the 2 studies together, they didn't note that it was better than dextromethorphan. But dextromethorphan, which is like Robitussin DM, is one of the common brands that has dextromethorphan. They did note that the patients who had that reported significant side effects of excessive sleepiness and other side effects that parents were concerned about. So I'm with Pooh. I think you should go ahead, load up on honey in your tea, or take it straight, particularly if you're having that bad cough at bedtime. I was able to find brands of buckwheat honey online, but not quite so in the store. That said, I tell my parents that they can go out and buy any honey they can find, and many of them come back and say the regular old clover honey does a good job as well. The other thing to know about honey is that definitely with unpasteurized honey, that there are actually anti-inflammatory properties to the honey that also can help. And I didn't include this in this talk because I didn't find studies to say one way or the other, but salt water, so saline, so you know, gargling with the warm salty water for sore throat, is a way to create a hostile environment for a virus or a bacteria, and that's why that can help with a sore throat. You're creating a hostile environment. So I throw the gargles in for the older kids, particularly if after a lot of coughing or they're very sick, they have sore throat. So on to chapter 3. We now know how to take care of ourselves when we're sick. What about the general things to kind of help with some childhood issues? I have 3 kids, and I breastfed my babies, and definitely I remember being told, I was told by my mom, I was told by my husband's mother, in the beginning period where you're waiting for your milk to come in, have a Guinness, right? Guinness will totally help you make more milk, and you won't have to worry about it. And so this cartoon is great. This mom's drinking her beer, her baby's happy, she's happy. This mom, her glass is empty, her baby's sad, and she's sad. Very appealing. So one of the things that is known about beer is there is a hormone that is normally produced to help with milk production, prolactin, that when you drink beer, it causes that hormone level to increase. Both in, and the key word here is non-lactating humans, so taking humans aren't breastfeeding and then measuring their blood levels, you see that, and in experimental animals. The key thing to know also, but the component in the beer is not in the alcohol part, but in the barley. And so people have been able to show the same thing in non-alcoholic beer that is made from barley. But there were a few researchers who really wanted to study it because it's definitely something that is promoted often. So one study that didn't seem to support it was this study that looked at 12 breastfeeding women and their infants. And these mothers were asked initially to pump a little breast milk, and then they were either given orange juice alone or orange juice with alcohol added to it. And then they continued to feed their babies, and then babies were weighed before and afterwards. And they also got milk samples along the way to kind of measure the quantity of milk. And what they saw, the results were that the moms who had alcohol in their orange juice noted that they felt there was an odor to their milk. So increased perception of alcohol odor to their milk about 30 minutes to 1 hour after drinking the alcohol. They noted for the babies of the mom who had the beverage with alcohol in it, the baby at the beginning seemed to suck more frequently, which is a good sign, right? They're feeding more. But when they weighed them afterwards to kind of estimate how much they got, that the babies who were fed the alcohol took in less milk, 120 mLs, versus the babies who had the non-alcoholic beverage. They took in 156. So there was this perception that, oh, they're feeding more vigorously, but they actually took in less. And unfortunately, the other study that I found looking at it was also to the con. It was a similar study, but they didn't like the first study because they said, you know, having the babies there and the moms smelling the alcohol on the milk, maybe those moms did something. They smelt the alcohol. They fed their babies shorter and said, oh, I think they're full. Let's take them off, because they were concerned that they were making their babies drunk. So this study looked at 17 women, and they tried to control for some of those concerns. So these moms had to come 2 days in a row. There were no babies there. There were no magazines in case a baby showed up in a magazine. There was no TV, nothing for them to do. And they were given two beverages, one that definitely had a good quantity of alcohol in it, and one where they put a little alcohol on the top so that drinking it, if they smelled the odor of alcohol, they still couldn't tell whether it was significant amounts of alcohol in it. So these women came in, they put an IV, and they were going to measure the blood levels of the hormones associated with breastfeeding. And they gave them 45 minutes to relax, then they were given their drinks, and then they had pumps put on, and they had milk samples expressed. And then the next day, those same women came back, and whatever beverage they had the first day, they had the opposite one, because knowing that different women with pumping might produce different amounts of breast milk. And so what they saw from the blood test levels, they were measuring three hormones. Prolactin, which I already told is the hormone that kind of makes you make breast milk. Oxytocin is the hormone that makes the milk be let down at the start of feeding. And they picked cortisol because that's another random hormone level that shouldn't change with breastfeeding or not, and shouldn't really change with alcohol consumption. And they also asked them how they were feeling, knowing that if women were feeling uncomfortable, that might affect how they felt, and they controlled for those things. And what they saw was their oxytocin levels, the ones that makes the letdown, went down, but their prolactin levels went up. But they also, their measures of feeling sedated, dysphoric, so not feeling particularly happy, or drunkenness, really increased in the group after they had alcohol. And that the changes in the oxytocin, the letdown hormone, were related to the lactation performance, so like how much milk came out and how long it took from when the pump started before the milk actually started to come. And that the prolactin levels, those going up, the higher your prolactin level was, the more drunk you reported feeling. And that higher cortisol levels weren't associated with any of the lactational performances. This doesn't project well, and I kept trying to get a better picture, but this picture is showing the weight of the mother and the number of drinks, and essentially they looked at their alcohol clearance, how long it took to get out of the milk. So they took all those samples of breast milk and measured alcohol levels in it. And what they found was that there were significant amounts of alcohol in the breast milk, and how long it took you to clear it depended on how much you weighed and how many drinks you had. So the more you weighed, the more drinks you had, the longer it took. But in general, it takes 2 to 3 hours to clear one serving of alcohol in a woman who is breastfeeding. So that effect of kind of affecting how much milk letdown you have actually persists for a while. And if you had 2 drinks, 3.5 to 5 hours. So essentially, drinking beer while you're breastfeeding really just results in this. All right. So this is the most common question that I get when people are traveling. They don't want to know about vaccines, or they're not asking me about infection, the recirculated air. It's, what's that medicine that I can give to my baby when we get on the plane so they can go to sleep so I don't have to worry about disturbing all the other passengers? And I will tell you my anecdote. When I was moving back from Chicago here, my husband hadn't finished with his job, so I had a 15-month-old. So she and I flew the first time together from Chicago here. And we got to pre-board, and as I was pre-boarding, there was a woman in line in front of me, and she turned around and she just said, in my day, we used to give them just a touch of whiskey. And my daughter wasn't crying. She was perfectly happy in my hands. And I was like, no, please don't let me sit next to her. You know, if she cries, I'm going to feel bad. Of course, she sat right behind us. I will tell you, my daughter was an angel on that flight. And when we got off, she also said, I didn't even realize that she was right there because I never heard her. But, you know, lots of parents have that anxiety. And I'll tell you, even the Dalai Lama would consider it. So I actually think this is a really interesting story. So this is a photo of the Livingston family, Jeannie Livingston, her husband Rob, her three and a half year old and 22 month old. They had gone to Singapore, and they were on a flight back from Singapore to Seattle, and they had a stopover in Tokyo. When they stopped over in Tokyo, the Dalai Lama got on. He was sitting in the row behind him. So he was on this flight. They took this photo because, you know, they were sitting near the Dalai Lama, and they kept it for their own personal uses. And then they got contacted by the Seattle Times, because 4 days later, when the Dalai Lama was getting an honorary degree from the University of Washington, he talked about this family. And he said, he was talking about compassion, and that compassion needed to be cultivated from birth. And he used the flight as an example. He said that everything was nice for a start. He gave the children candy. I hope their dentists weren't listening. But then the toddler stayed awake all night, shouting, crying, and moving. He said the mom patiently comforted him, keeping him occupied and walking with him. The whole time I thought, if I was in that position, I may not have had that sufficient patience. So if the Dalai Lama can't have patience with a crying baby on a plane, why should any of the rest of us? So the common medicine that people talk about is Benadryl. We've all had that experience. We've taken Benadryl and we feel kind of woozy and sleepy. A little bit nicer than the whiskey, the image of giving my daughter a shot of whiskey. But I did have that moment of like, oh, should I have brought some Benadryl? Should I have given her some Benadryl? So it's a tired study, trial of infant response to diphenhydramine, the active ingredient that's in Benadryl. They looked at 44 infants, 6 to 15 months, and they were either given a placebo or Benadryl before bedtime. So the parents didn't know what they were getting. And then had the parents report how many times they woke up at night, that required the parent to come and do something for them. And then the secondary outcomes was whether the parents thought their infant's sleep was better, how happy the parents were with sleep, and the improved sleep latency, the time between when you put them down and then when they actually go to bed. And this trial was stopped early because they were concerned about safety. There were a number of reports of side effects to Benadryl. 1 in 22 of the infants who got Benadryl showed benefit, 3 of the 22, and the placebo was just syrup. So there was nothing in the syrup, and we oftentimes think sugar revs kids up. That should have made their sleep improve over time. Another study, this is an older one done in 1976, was in a sleep study lab. So these were parents who had gotten to the end of their rope with their kids falling asleep, brought them to the sleep study clinic. Please do something to help my child go to sleep. There was nothing medically wrong with them. They just had disordered sleep. So 50 children, 2 to 12 years of age, and things like they wouldn't fall asleep for more than 45 minutes. They woke up a lot of times. Their sleep was really short, so they went to bed late, woke up early. They were restless, had nightmares, sleep terrors, sleepwalking, or in the morning, because they would fall asleep so late, their parents couldn't get them to wake up. And they showed similar effects. The Benadryl made no difference in terms of falling asleep. So even though it's a known side effect of Benadryl that it can make you sleepy, it's just not that reliable. The other thing to understand also, which is one of the things I caution parents about, is Benadryl also has the opposite side effect. It can make you irritable. It makes you drowsy but irritable. So when parents ask me about that and they say, oh, I gave them Benadryl once when they were sick and he conked out and fell asleep, that if your child were to have that opposite side effect, being irritable, how much more difficult it would be to manage them on the flight when it takes about 4 hours for that Benadryl to kind of work its way out of their system. So unfortunately, not much can be done for a child who is going on a flight. I recommend distraction, maybe trying to pick a red eye where it's close to their natural sleep time, and, you know, maybe buy drinks for the rows around you if your child really loses it. So chapter four. This is interesting because I showed my husband these slides yesterday, and he saw this one. He's like, the 5-second rule. I thought that was common knowledge, but when I show you the results, it explains why. But for those of you who don't know, the 5-second rule is you're eating something, your favorite thing, it falls on the floor and you quickly pick it up. It's still safe to eat because it's not been 5 seconds, right? So the first real actual study of this was done by a high school student. So high school students can advance science. And actually, this high school student won an award. It was called the Ig Nobel Prize. And it's a public health parity award for people who do like a really interesting study that's in the interest of public health, but it doesn't really meet the scientific merit of a normal Nobel Prize. So Jillian Clark, she's from Chicago, and she was aware of this, and she did a study, and she took a tile and put E. coli on it and then dropped a variety of foods on it, and all of them, in under 5 seconds, were able to acquire the E. coli that was inoculated on the tile. The other thing that she did, which I thought was clever, is that she looked also to see if gender made a difference in the type of food. So of note, women are more likely than men to eat food that's been on the floor. I found that hard to believe, because, you know. And then, of course, as we wouldn't find hard to believe, cookies, candy, more likely to be picked up off the floor and eaten. But cauliflower and broccoli, not so much. People are willing to let that one go. There was another study, actually, it was done through Clemson University, and this was actually published. Again, using another type of infection that can cause GI illness, so salmonella. And in this one, they did different types of flooring, right? Maybe it's the tile. Maybe that was really porous tile that made things live. So they looked at wood, tile, and nylon carpet. And that found that when you put it on the floor and you did normal cleaning of the floor, vacuuming the carpet, mopping and sweeping, 28 days later, you still were able to detect that exact strain of salmonella that you put on there. And then they put salmonella, they made the conditions arid and dry and not nice, and then they dropped the food 8 hours later, because we know that moisture makes organisms live, so they were trying to create a hostile environment. And they found that the bacteria could still contaminate bread and bologna in under 5 seconds. So bread, a dry food, and bologna, a moist food. And that if it stayed for a minute, the contamination increased tenfold with the tile and carpet surfaces. So definitely it happened more commonly. So for that one, this does not happen. Once it's on the floor, it's dirty and you risk contamination. So those are my chapters that take us through kind of some of the common wives' tales. There's many other ones that are out there. And when you come into medicine, you do have that bias of there's a medicine to treat it and there needs to be science, and maybe some of the things that were done for me when I was a child, my parents didn't know better, my grandparents didn't know better, but I've come full circle in my career and find that there's a lot of evidence supporting some of the things that you grew up doing, your grandparents grew up doing for you, and there's many other studies. The eating after swimming has been studied, lots of other things that you've been told have been studied. So thank you, and I welcome any questions. Okay, so the question was to go on about eating after swimming. So that study was done in a select population. So they took elite athletes who were swimmers, and they gave them a carbohydrate-heavy meal right before competing in a race, and they then at another time had them be their normal not eating before swimming, and they looked at swimming times, and there was no difference in swimming performance. There were no adverse outcomes such as drowning, but there were some small number of people who complained of abdominal pain after eating and then swimming. And the abdominal pain sometimes can be, and particularly for those elite athletes, was a competition between blood flow going to your stomach to help you digest food and going to your limbs to swim. So it's not dangerous, you won't die or you won't drown, but you're certainly going to feel uncomfortable, so it's probably best, if not necessary, to give yourself a chance to digest your food and then go in the water. So the question was that oftentimes, and this happens, we do this at work all the time. I have a cold, but I'm not that contagious. I'm not that sick. I'm not sneezing. I'm not coughing. I'm not contagious. So you're actually contagious 24 hours before you notice your symptoms. So one of the things that we don't take into account is that day leading up to it where you're kind of feeling not right, you can be contagious. And actually, you can shed virus up to 8 days after an illness. So your symptoms might be better, but you still have viruses in your secretions, which is why getting an infection is so rampant. And oftentimes we don't remember that person who we were in contact who's sick. I remember the person who was contact who was sick. It was my 3-year-old niece visiting me from Seattle, and she was sick, and that's how I got the cold that I am fighting now. But most people don't remember. No one was coughing next to you. I was on my plane. I was on my flight. The person sitting there wasn't. Viruses are hardy in order to survive, so they live on surfaces for a long time, and they can live in your airway for a long time. Because remember, the symptoms that we have is when our body's actively in fighting it. Once our body feels like it's contained, our symptoms actually get better, but it doesn't mean that the virus has been eliminated. So it's definitely in your secretions. So that's why whether somebody has allergies or something got caught in their throat, you still cover your mouth when you cough. You don't just cough into the air, because viruses that might be living in your airway, you're aerosolizing it for others to get. So you are correct. Fever is our body trying to create a hostile environment to kind of stop that infection. So taking away, and it's one arm of our immune system, doesn't seem like the right thing to do, right? The idea that you take away one of our many tools in our toolkit doesn't seem like the right thing to do. But I would balance it between that there are definitely some people who fever makes them miserable. My daughter, my eldest, when she is sick, you see it. You look at her and her face has changed, and I know she has a fever without touching her. My middle son, he's had some of the highest temperatures ever, and he's running around, and it's when I'm grabbing him to say, don't jump off of that thing. I'm like, gosh, you're really hot. Is it because you're sweaty? Let's get the thermometer. And his temperature is like 103, and all he wants to do is for me to let go of him so he can go on playing. You know, so different people respond to fever differently, and certainly for my daughter, even if she's 99, I'm breaking out something to give her, because otherwise she gets really cranky. For my son, I might leave him alone. If he's playing and he doesn't want to take anything, why am I treating him when it's not bothering him? I know one of the things that if you do go to Dr. Marmer's talk, she's going to talk about there's new studies looking at Tylenol, which we all thought was pretty benign. You know, I know that before those studies, for a number of years, I said to parents, well, what's the harm of Tylenol? It's a benign medicine. Maybe not so much anymore. There's some reports linking acetaminophen to asthma for a vaccine. So one of the common times that parents ask me, what's that Tylenol dose, is, you know, I've given their children vaccines. They're going to get pain because I just stuck needles in their legs. And then oftentimes one of your immune responses to the vaccines is to develop fever. So those parents are like, you just did something to ruin my night. What can I do to get my evening back? And I used to be, oh, yeah, give a dose of Tylenol. There was a study that showed giving Tylenol around vaccine actually blunts your immune response to the vaccine. So there am I doing something painful to give them protection, and then right behind it I'm doing something that might make their antibody levels lower. So the idea that lots of medicines that we assumed were safe because they're safe in adults might not actually be safe in children. But go to Dr. Marmer's talk, and she'll talk a lot about fever, her talks on fever in children, which, as parents know, if your child has a fever, it just ruins your day. All right. Well, thank you for coming and being a wonderful audience.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.